What are we doing here? It's about a new project Jeff Carlin and I are putting together called the Palikari Project. What does that mean, Nick, exactly?
It means like a strong warrior, basically.
Right.
Palikari, you know?
Brave, strong, brave warrior. Right.
Yeah.
It's about my father, Spiros Cass, came here, destroyed by the war, skinny as a rail, lost and broken, and put together a life in America, which he always loved, to the point of, well, he would fight a war if the United States asked him to. He would fight a war against his former country, Greece. It's about his journey as a young boy in a village, the small, beautiful village of Rizes, Arcadia. In his own words, we worked on this years ago, and we thought the tapes were lost. My brother Nick and I sat down to interview our dad in 1989, right, Nick? I think.
Something like that, yeah.
And we got him to tell stories. Our voices were different, but his voice was strong and the same. And he told stories about hiding in the well, in the a room behind the oven in the village, in the backyard, hiding from the communists. What else did he talk about? His best friend, the communist Taikis Mourlopoulos, the communist of in the Greek army after the Greek troops capitulated against the Germans, and how he did not want to join the Communist Party. He was with the king. He was a conservative. And all that happened to him, in his words. And we thought we'd lost the tapes. Betty and I were looking for them, but Betty found them. And they were originally made, was at Columbia College. That's where we met. I've written about that.
Mm-hmm.
And Columbia had asked her, and she was part of the dance department. Columbia had asked her, through the Illinois Arts Council, to put together a ballet. And she did one. She decided the subject would be my father, as part of a concert that she gave. And she called it Palikari, about an immigrant's journey, in his words. And when we found them, Jeff liked the tapes and polished them up a little bit. And I'd like Nick to talk about it. Nick, what did you think? You heard a bit of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, I mean, just thanks, John, again. Jeff, thank you so much for doing this. Obviously, for the family, it means a great deal to hear
everything. Yeah.
You know, long gone voice of your father. And so it's extremely powerful in that respect. It's also very powerful because of the stories that he told of a land that doesn't exist anymore, Greece of that era.
Or America of that era.
Or America of that era, frankly. These places do not exist anymore. And to tell them with such clarity and to tell the stories, you know, some, you know, about just normal life, some about the experiences he had in Albania, in the war, in a village in occupied Greece, and also in some of the extraordinary things that he had to go through in the Civil War as well, and to, you know, hear those stories and to think about, you know, a man who went through all that and then came to America and became 110% American and, you know, raised his family and his kids. It was just amazing to me.
What I hope, besides I hope that you'll listen to the parts and truly enjoy them and write to John Cass News, and there'll be parts where you can comment on them, and I want to hear them. But I also hope that everyone listening will take your phone with a voice memo app or a tape recorder and sit down with your parents and ask them the story of their life, because they're not always going to be here. And it's very difficult to deal with. I don't think I could have. I didn't record that tape, those tapes, thinking that my dad was going to die. In my view, he was the strongest man on earth. He was never going to die, but he did. He died of a heart attack, stubbornly insisting that he was going to drive his Cadillac to the hospital. I mean, you can't, you know, the most stubborn man I know. But I hope that all of you can do that with your uncle, with your father, with your mother, with your aunt. So Nick and I was at the Chicago Tribune then, or just starting, and I had a tape recorder, a decent cassette tape recorder, probably paid too much for it. And we sat downstairs at the card table, right, Nick?
Yeah.
In the old house in Oak Lawn, the house that I grew up in, that we grew up in. And my dad had a cup of coffee and his pack, ever-present pack of Winston cigarettes, and you can hear him lighting them. And he talked for hours with us, and he had never wanted to talk about any of it. Dad, what about what happened? What about the communists? How did you survive that? Dad, how did you get to the palace of the king to fight the communists? How did you get past all those communist checkpoints? Dad, what was the war in Albania like, really like? He's like, Asta, leave it. You know, the thing about the voices, my brother Nick and I were a lot younger. I hadn't smoked for 30 years. And my brother Nick hadn't yet been stressed by his work in CIA and State Department. And we sounded like kids that we were. The kids we were. We sounded like we had the voice of milk drinkers, as we say. And I know we tease each other about that. But my father's voice sounds true. Especially true when he says the word communists. Hope you enjoy the Palikari Project with my father, produced by Jeff Carlin. Should, I hope, win some sort of awards on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
We have to be, so we don't make a lot of noise with the pago and everything. Yeah, okay. Quiet.
Yeah,
it's on. It's working. If you were going to tell the story of your life, where would you begin?
My name is Spiro Cash, Kashidoganish. I was born in a small village in near Tripolis.
No, that's okay, just keep going.
Near Tripolis, Riz is the name. I was born, as I said, July 29, 1918. Rizes is about 2,000 population in the Tegea. Tegea is 11 miles or starting right in the outskirts of Tripolis.
In Arcadia.
In Arcadia, yeah. Our family story, my father never talked about it. When I was young, 3-4 years old, I remember my grandpa, who was about maybe 6'3", 6'4", tall, very tall, skinny, which he died when he was 112 years old. He never had aspirin. He never had a doctor. He never got cold. He never slept inside the house. He was sleeping outside in an open porch, even with the snow. He never got inside the house. The last day of his life, my father told his father, my grandpa, please, you have to come inside. The doctor says, you are very sick. You have to come inside. And my grandpa says, John, my father, John, don't take me inside because I'm going to die if you take me inside. Finally, they took him inside, and my grandpa died the same night inside the house. He never, first time in his life, he went inside the house to sleep or just to relax.
What did he do?
He was outside. He had my grandpa had about 100, 150 sheep, which he was a shepherd all his life from a young kid. Up to his death, he was working. He had his sheep up to the 112 years old. Up in the mountains, down the mountains, all over the place.
Walking.
And he's walking, actually. And his diet most of the time was cheese, olives, and bread. He didn't have salami or anything with him. Cheese, olive, and bread. Maybe when he was coming home to nighttime, they maybe had some noodles, some a little meat once in a while. But he was, I remember, he was coming one day to my father's restaurant because he was coming a lot of times, every 2-3 times a week. And I was playing next to the street in a little ditch with other neighborhood kids, which were about the same age, 2-3 years old. And I saw him coming. And I tried to hide inside the ditch. I put my head down, and he came. And I was watching him what he could do. He came, he stood on top of the street, and he reached down without to break his knee at all, and he picked me up from my clothes from the back, and he lifted me up, and he put me under his arm, and he took me home. I was trying to get away from him by making noise and crying. I didn't want to go home, but he took me there anyway.
So what was his family like and his brothers? And how old is the family?
The family was from another village. They had sheep from another village named Doriza. They're north of Tripolis. We are south of east of Tripolis. They are north of Tripolis. And they came to the village, to Rizes. They were renting the mountains. They paid the village money to let them stay with our sheep in the mountains. They did. And little by little, they stay there all the time. They didn't want to leave Rizes because they like it. Because it was a better life. I had a little store to buy bread or to buy a little meat or macaroni or something, you know. And they stayed there anyway. Their name was Talaganis. My grandpa, great-grandpa, he didn't have a hair. He was bald-headed. And that time they call it kashida, that means some kind of sickness when you don't have a hair on your head, if you are bald. And they call it kashida, that's why he got the nickname Kashidogenis. John with a kashida. John with bald-headed John. In the village, very, very, very few people they have. The village engineers, they know them by their name. They have all nicknames. All the village engineers, they have nicknames. For instance, my father's nickname was Kutulas, because he was his father-in-law, when my father was young, he was his father-in-law asked him how you drink the milk with a wooden plate, a wooden bowl, and they call it kutuli. That's why my grandpa, that means my father's father-in-law, he named him Kutula. He gave him the nickname.
What's Talaganis?
Talaganis was a name before my family's. Talaganis, that means that, how do you call it? Sore, yeah. Probably they had all they were sores.
Sword.
Sword,
machete, right?
Sword.
Sword,
yeah.
Like a big cutting knife.
Yeah, cutting knife. How do you call it? The other knife, machete.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of people were they?
Probably I never met, but I met.
Have you heard the stories of
them? Yeah. My grandpa, as I said, was a wonderful man, but his brother was 18 years old.
When was your grandpa born?
Grandpa? 1921, I think.
No,
1821. In a Greek Epanastas Revolution.
Right.
War of against the Turks.
War of Independence in 1821.
Yeah, 1821.
Well, what did you, as a boy, hear from those days?
I hear all the stories about the Turks, how they punished the Greeks.
Like what?
Like they take some women, they whip the Greeks. If you don't work for him, they don't let you have water from their own wells. You have to go far away to get some water for your family or your horses. And they take all the wheat, all whatever you produce. They take the half or whatever they feel like to take. There was occupation at the time.
For how long?
For 400 years.
That's Greeks.
No, this was not the Turks.
Yenzars,
yeah.
What was that?
The Turks, I don't know what year, but they decide to take some Greek boys, youngsters, 6, 4, 3 years old. They took them away from their mothers and fathers, and they took them back to Turk, and when they grew up, they teach them to be army. They call it Yanitsari, to fight the Greeks. Yanitsari, to fight the Greeks. And probably they fought the Greeks, but then the Yanitsari find out later they were a Greek boys. What? And then probably they give up or what happened at the time, probably they kill them, what?
No, in the Koryo, above the Koryo, there's a cave.
Yeah.
They used to tell us about that.
I don't know, but the cave was anything
real. Where they used to hide, what did they used to say?
Uh-huh.
Where they hid.
The people, they hide in the mountains. All those little mountains and tall mountains, they have a lot of trees that time. Because the people, they come down from the mountains, hit the Turks, and go back to the mountains. And the Turks decide to burn the mountain, all the trees, all the mountains. They burn them up, and they make them without trees. Only little bushes at the time, you know.
What's that in doing?
Now, after so many years, because the Greek people don't cut wood anymore from the mountains, they grow up, they are real big, trees. No wood, nothing. There was only.
What did it look like? It
looked like a desert. The mountains, you know, just a little green bushes, but no trees.
So in 1821, your grandfather was born.
Born, and his brother, I think, was a little older than him, my grandpa.
What was his name?
Sofianos.
Tell us about
him. Yeah. Sofianos, when he was 18 years old, he had he had 100 black sheep. Everybody had white sheep. He had a black sheep, and nobody can take it and put it in his stani. They call it a group of animals. and he had 40 horses. He was like cowboy. 40 horses, he used it once a year to crack the wheat out of the, how do you call those?
Shells. To thresh the wheat.
To crush the wheat. And then when he finished, he collects some money from the job he was doing and let the horses loose up in the mountains and down in the straight land. And the people got upset for that. And he had a lot of court orders because his horses or his sheep going down in the land and eat all the crabs. And he had a lot of court orders.
How did he get all these sheep? He was 18. What happened?
Probably he stole it.
Oh. And being a bonus.
Yeah. In the shallow villages and far away. When he was about 20 years old, I heard the old man, Grigoratis, his name, he was telling us all the stories. My father never talked about his grandpa, his Theo uncle. And then he says he was going down to the from Greece, from Peloponnesus, with another guy, another friend. They were going up to Bulgaria, mountains, go to Bulgaria, steal or wrestle animals from Bulgaria and bring it down to Greece, and steal from Greece and take it to Bulgaria. From one side to the other, he was making money. And that's why he got all those court orders. Finally, they could not catch him, or he never went to the court. Finally, the last order was capture him, or kill him. You know, if you don't catch it, kill him. He was 6'4". Tall and skinny. He could go up in the mountain, which we call Mayolas. I think it's about 6-7. About maybe 2-3 miles long. High the village, the mountain, and when his mother called him from the village, he could hear his mother. He called him, "The bread is ready." Before she finished, "The bread is ready," he was in the village. A few seconds later, he was running down like a rabbit, the same way he was going up. In a few 5 minutes or 4 minutes, he was up in the top again with his animals.
And then his gang.
And
didn't he have his friends up there too?
Yeah, probably he had.
He was a
thief.
Robber?
Robber, yeah.
Highway robber?
Not a robber, only for animals, hustler.
And he'd go to Bulgaria and steal from there?
Bulgaria and keep it here in Greece. And then keep it. Take it from Greek soil and take it to Bulgaria or Albania. You know, he developed a line, you know. And that's why they had the court order to kill him.
Dead or alive?
Dead or alive, yeah. And
did he have any friends in the village?
Yeah, he had friends. He was engaged, a girl, in a village. And it was June, the end of June, when they cut the wheat. And he was coming down from, because he had the house about a little higher than all the other houses. He had a horse, a white horse he was riding all the time. He was coming down to see his fiancée. But the police, they had another apostolos. They blocked him in the
blockade
in the way. And when the police get up from the behind the trees with the horses and ask him to stop, he stopped, okay, but he says, my horse is very wild. Please give me, let me get down. He didn't rely on the horse to run away. He didn't know they're going to kill him, they're going to shoot him. He thought he was going to take off, nobody could catch him. It was a straight land. When he started moving, when he got down from the horse, he took off without the horse, running. And they tried to capture him with the horses in the straight level land. They couldn't catch him. Each second, they're losing time. They're losing...
He wanted to go up.
No, he was straight at the time. And the horse, he was running over on the horses. And they start shooting him. And one bullet got him on the thigh, or he was jumping something there, and he died right there. He got a hemorrhage. That's the stories I heard about my grandpa's brother from the village in here, Grigorak. My father, or he didn't know, or he never talked about it.
And where he died?
He died right there, and now they call it, the place there, they call it Sofianos.
At the time when you were a little boy, what did Rizes look like? What did the mountains look like, and what did the people look like? How did they dress? How did they act? How did they live? How did the people live?
The people live by growing things, growing vegetables, potatoes, onions, tomatoes and everything, and some trees. And they live from their own crops and exchange some of the crops for oil and little meat once in a while they had. But in the villages they have chickens, rabbits, a lot of eggs, and the mothers, they make cheese because they have 2-3 sheep and goats. And they have they make the noodles and a trahana, which is like a oatmeal. They use it. They used to eat all the winter. Growing up, I look around. Had a lot of dreams. What I'm gonna do in the village when I was young? I was thinking to make a big place, big grocery store, a big butcher shop, big cafenio. You know, tear everything down and make it big. But probably the time I didn't have money, but I had a dream, so. Now, 1939.
You didn't want to be a doctor?
No.
You didn't like school too much?
No, I like school, but my father didn't have money to send me no place. And I didn't ask because I had a feeling. You know, we don't have money. How can I go to Athens? The college, you know, because my father didn't have money at all. Well, what we were making just for living money, not expenses. We buy one pair of shoes a year, and maybe a pair of working shoes. That's all was, all year. And then if they have holes, you put a new soles and all those things, you keep them for a year.
When you were a little boy going to school, did you wear shoes?
Yeah, I had shoes. My father, one thing, he didn't allow anybody to walk without shoes. He was afraid we might get caught. It cost more money than the shoes.
You had a friend then?
Yeah.
When you were a little boy?
I have a lot of friends.
Simeon.
When I was in school, what happened, the first day in school, our teacher, which was my nephew, my uncle, not for second uncle, he was talking to us outside in the field in front of the school to be a good people. Don't bother anybody. Don't touch anybody's property. Love the birds. Love the animals. And the same time he was talking about those things, I saw a little bird behind the in a tree, and I pick up a little stone from the ground, and I bent down and shot with my arm, I shot the bird and I killed him. a bird fell down. And another guy says, another schoolboy says, teacher, Spiro killed a bird. Did you kill a bird? I didn't answer. He says, okay, I'll talk to the shepherd. When we went inside the school, he called me over. He called me up. He grabbed my ear. He said, what, Goofy, what I told you, what I was saying that time, you heard the bird. You killed the bird. Well, I didn't know. I said, I didn't know I was going to kill him. I just to chase him away. Anyway, he started spanking me, you know, pulling my ear, my ears and my hair. And my cousin, his son, Lau, he ran out of the school. He called me, come on, we go. He was my support. And we went out, ran away from school, which was the first and the last time I'd done that. Because my mother and my father were very strict about school. You cannot do those things. You know, maybe you do it one time, but not second time. You're going to pay a lot from my father and my mother.
What did it look like? How were the houses built?
Our house, you mean? Our house was a two-story house, two stories. The store was on the bottom floor, and we live upstairs, in the second floor. And we had about 10 small places for to put the mules, put another two little rooms, two, three rooms for the people to stay there. But anyway, my father opened the store. He was trying to make little money to survive because he was a little spoiled in the United States. Better life, he had a little money, and now he became poor again. And he had 8 children, which was very hard for him to feed us, you know. But thanks God we had the little farms, and we produce almost what we need to have the time to survive.
What did you produce?
Potatoes, tomatoes, all the vegetables, beans, a lot of beans and all those things.
How did you go there?
Huh?
Did the Unitas and the men go there in the
room? The Unitas, everybody was working, even the children. We were 6, 7 years old. We had to do things. Pick up the potatoes, or pick up the beans, or pick up something, or water the vegetables with the wells. We had the wells at the time, and somebody, one kid stay and
take care of the meal. What were the wells like?
The wells were a hole down in the ground, but maybe 30 feet deep or 40 with buckets and the magani, we call it. What's a...
With pump.
Pump, not pump.
Winch.
Winch, they call it.
To pull the buckets up.
And part of the buckets up, yeah. And...
How did it work?
Yeah?
How did it work?
The mule goes around. And the buckets come one after the other. They drop the water in a funnel. Mm-hmm. And from there goes to the ground in the place you want to take the water, you know, and water the vegetables.
So, Louisa said 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a nice, beautiful village. We had two doctors at the time, I think. One we call him Barba Cristo, which was, my mother was his helper for, she helped the doctor a lot of places, like bring the babies, you know. What do you call it?
Midwife.
Yeah, midwife, and he never charged us for anything. But when I grew up a little bit, I had a bike and I take the doctor around to the other villages, put him on the back of my bike because of, he didn't have not even a horse. He was a poor doctor, but very nice man. He never charged anybody for anything. He was the godfather to the village. Yeah, my mother was...
Who knows that in our family?
Huh? Very much Americanized, because she lived here in the United States about 10 years, I think. Yeah, about 10 years. And she was a daughter of a shepherd. Her family had a lot of sheep, maybe thousands. And she came from, not from the village only, she came from the mountains, real. And then from the village. And when she came to the United States, she never went to school anyway, to the Greek school. She didn't know how to read and write, but she learned by herself to read and write, you know, in Greek. And then she was Americanized more than anybody else I knew. A lot of people came here in the United States. They went back in a few years, or 10 or 15. They were the same people they left the village, but my mother was different. You know, she came to the village. Already she knew about medicine, how to tie broken hands or help the doctor or, you know, do those things. And the village engineers, they believe her and they call her all over. She never charged anybody a penny, you know.
Η χωριά της, της είπαν Αμερικανίδα.
Yeah, probably they did.
Αυτό ήταν.
No, but my mother was a different person. She could talk to anybody. She could talk to the president in English, little English she knew, or she talked to the lowest village in here the same way. She was not embarrassed of anything. We do not have it, what mother had. We all took from my father, shy a little bit, you know, not like my mother. You know, I don't know, my sons are a little more like my mother. They like to talk.
A quick aside here, this is Jeff Carlin with a note. Spiro's talking about his mother and this Americanization she undertook and these skills and how she could step in as the doctor and help mend broken bones and do things like that. A lot of those skills she picked up while she was living in Chicago, and she picked them up from the Hull House here, which, if you're not aware, is the often called the Jane Addams Hull House. It was a settlement house that was established by Jane Addams and also Ellen Gates Starr, and it was designed to offer skills and resources for newly immigrated Europeans. In Chicago. It was founded in 1889, kind of the near west side of Chicago. And it's a very important piece of Chicago history. And interesting, Spiro's mother was able to use those skills, take them back with her to the gold world and, you know, step in for the doctor of the town and mend broken bones and maybe perform miracles, as some might think, or probably say. But she owes a lot of that to what she learned at the Hull House here in Chicago, which is the cool little connection to the Chicago way. And another quick note, too, while I've got your attention, Spiro says villageneers a lot. And he means the word villagers, but it's his fun way of saying villageneers, which I think is a better way of saying it. So I would run with that from now on. But yeah, just a quick aside. I want to catch up on that. But please... enjoy more of the Policari project.
I was growing up, my father had a general store in the small town of the Rizes. He was butchering animals, and some groceries, and we had a lot of wine there for selling the wine to the people by gallons or by glasses or whatever. When I was growing up, I had a lot of friends, but still I didn't know what's going on at the time when I was about 8-10 years old. But when I was 11 years old, my three sisters left Greece and came to the United States. They were American born, they came easy. My father tried to come with them, it was very impossible. My father and my mother, they were here from 1907 to 1916. And because my father got sick, he couldn't walk much because he had a peddler all so many cold days here in Chicago. He had a little money. And they decided to go back as long as she could work. When my sisters left, the pain was so great. I still feel it. I could go inside the house. I have to run outside. Now, when I was about 15 years old, my father tried to give me confidence to go to buy animals, to learn something about it or kill them. And he gave me some money. He says, go in that village.
Where?
About 2-3 hours far away.
Where?
Well, they know no place, just land between Doljana. Doljana and Kato Doljana. Upper Doljana and Kato, down Doljana.
Where is this place?
Hagia Sophia, very deep.
In the mountains.
The mountains. The animals, they stay in the mountains. They build something just Prohor for the time being, and they feed the animals there, and then they move it. They move another place. And then I went, I think I bought about 50 or 100 animals.
What? Sheep?
Sheep and goats. And my father was very surprised I could find them. It was all nice and heavy, you know, very good animals. And then I started working at the store, butcher animals like cows, not too many cows, but a lot of sheep and goats, and we sell it in the store by a pound, by oka. That's a Greek weight measure at the time. And then...
Did you have a dog then?
Yeah, I had a dog. I had a dog which was my cousin's dog, and I treated him real well. He didn't want to go by my cousin anymore.
Tell us how what happened. You brought the dog. You said, look at this dog I have. And tell the whole story. You know how to tell it.
Tell the whole story.
I don't remember. 1945, maybe. When I was 12 years old, I went to the school.
Maybe.
No, 15. I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
After grammar school, I went to another school and for 2 years. And after that, I was already 15 about now. I went to work for my father, tried to work the little farms we had, tried to apply my knowledge to the little farms. And then because I was a butcher at the time, I needed the dog. And my cousin had a dog. And the dog came in the store one day by itself, and I fed him Greek cheese, the hard Greek cheese, like Romano.
Yeah.
Yeah, he liked it a lot. A few hours later, he came back. I fed him again. A few days later, he didn't go to his house. He stayed in our place. My cousin came and says, well, my dog's here. Yeah, he stays out. I said to him, well, he took it back home. A few hours later, the dog was back to me. And we had on and off for a few months. He could keep the dog there because You know, I feed him the Greek cheese, the Romano cheese. He liked it a lot. And my cousin says, okay, let him stay with you. Now, the dog was 6 months old, the time 6, 7 months old. And I tried to teach him how to help me. It was a boxer, but maybe 100 pounds, 120, very heavy, very muscular dog. And he did not like anybody, but he never bothered anybody. Even my sisters, they done something to him, he went to after them. Good thing they locked the door. But he was loose in the store, you know. Outside the store, he was loose. He never beat anybody, he never barked anybody. But after we closed the doors, he was like a lion. You could go near the doors then. Anyway, when you are growing up in a small village, it's like you growing up with everybody else together. We always had a little bread to eat, or a chicken, or a rabbit, domestic rabbits, or eggs. Or my mother used to make noodles and spaghetti and those things. And we were, as long as you are young, you don't understand what might be happening later, you are happy. Probably my mother, my father, they were not too happy with the conditions Greece was going through that time. 1939, I went to the service. About 1940, I think it was October, 1st of October, we went, they sent us already in the first line without, we didn't know what's going on at the time, why we went in the first, in Albania, because Albania was occupied already by the Italians, and we didn't know why they sent us up there, but pretty soon we learned the Italians, they want to occupy Greece because Metaxas says, I'm not going to allow you to go through Greece. You know, they want to go through with the okay of the Greek government because they didn't want any trouble. It was easier for them to go through Greece and do whatever they want without any war or any killing. And Metaxas says, no, you're not going to go through. Όχι. That's historical. Όχι, the time for Greece. I think they're still in the mountains written with asbestos. Όχι. Like you see here in California, where it says Beverly. What? Beverly Hill? No.
Hollywood.
Hollywood. Was written in the mountains the same way with a... But
TNOE, όχι.
Όχι, that means we're not going to let you go. We're not going to let you come through Greece. Όχι. That means no.
All right, quick aside here, listener. One of the best things about this project is I'm learning a lot of modern Greek history. You know, I do love a good history story. But what Spiros is talking about right here is the Ochi, the day it's celebrated even to this day in Greece. It's a very important day. It's October 28th. It's a day of national celebration. And it's remembered as a day that the Greek prime minister at the times, Ioannis Metaxas, and apologize if I didn't nail that one, John, rejected this ultimatum from the Italians and the fascists and them trying to come through and march through the land. And he says no. And they put this sign up on the hill made out of asbestos, according to Spiros, that said, oh, he, you know, nope, no passage, not a chance. It's not going to happen. And it's this is 1940, by the way. And it's a really important day, apparently, according to the Ohi Foundation. It's celebrated as this, you know, day of standing up for what you believe in and saying none shall pass, essentially. And one of the many fun things, interesting things I've learned about this Greek history throughout this project. And I hope you're enjoying, too, because Spiros really does take you through this really tumultuous and upheaval in time and history in this region, which he alludes to a little bit, that how before that, you know, from the time of his grandfather being born in, you know, 1820, you know, he lived so long and it was the world around him was unchanged for so long. And so it's really amazing. And I hope you're enjoying his depiction of the time and when she was born. And I also wanted to mention too, and thank you for bearing with us too, because some of these tapes have really good sound. Some of them are, you know, things have moved on the table, or a glass has been shifted in front of the speaker and it's, you know, their hand is up or whatever it is. So bear with us as that plays out here. I think we do the best we can, doing the best we can to make it sound pretty good. And I think it sounds pretty good if you just don't listen too closely. But here it is, some more of Spiro Cass in the Pellicari project.
And then,
how did the people feel about it?
The people were with Metaxa at the time. They didn't want anybody to come through Greece. That was my problem, and still my problem. I don't want anybody to go through my country. I don't want anybody outside it to occupy my country. And now, in the first line, and all of a sudden we heard the Italians start shooting with artillery, with the machine guns, and then the war starts. We went through all winter up to Albania with one pair of shorts, underwear, and a pantaloni,
pants,
and a pants, and a coat, and a top coat, and one blanket. That's all I had, most of us in the Albania, but we never been dissatisfied because we knew our government cannot give us what we want. Anyway, we fought very vigorously, the Italians. Probably the Italians, they felt sorry, as we heard the time, for Greeks. Why we want to occupy Greece? There is no reason for us neighbors to go now and occupy countries here and there, Greece special. And Metaxa died, I think, by Christmas time, before Christmas, which all the army was so sad. We knew it's not going to be well for us anymore. And then, but 2 months later, we start pulling back.
Retreat. How about Faye? Did you have Faye?
Faye, we didn't have anything. The last dinner we had was spaghetti before we leave the first line. And I could not eat any. I was so hungry before. But when we retreat, I got so upset I couldn't eat any. My stomach got shut.
What was the fighting in the mountains like?
The fighting was
when you see Afghanistan, when you see that on television.
Yes, not like that. We had a line.
Right.
We had a line. The Italians had a line. But we didn't have what the Italians had. We didn't have the artillery. But they didn't move us back at all until we got the orders to go back. Anyway.
Was it cold? I remember you told me.
Cold. It was so cold. I remember a lot of times I get up from the little tent I had, and I couldn't feel my legs at all from the waist and down. I didn't know if I step in the air or in the ground, and I could feel them at all. It was almost cryopagimata, you know, cold bites, how you call it?
Frostbites,
yeah, something like that.
You used to say that when you were a little boy, you were always hunting, you knew there were people from the cities who would go up there. I remember you told me this once.
Yeah.
And you could tell that, somehow you could tell they didn't have
survival instincts. And I had the survival instincts.
How did you get it?
I never thought I'm going to be without food at all. I didn't steal anything, but I could eat roots, berries. I go to the mountains behind our line, and sometimes I pick up one lamb from somebody there without he wants me to do, but right. He didn't give it to me, almost like he stole it, because we had 10 days without anything, nothing, no bread, no food, anything. We were dizzy now. We couldn't drink water. It was so cold. And because the stomach was so empty, when I drank water a few times, it was like bitter, like you take poison. So bad was it. And I just wash our mouth. That's all we were doing. And I went, that time I remember, I took a friend of mine because we thought we were going to die. And we went hiding in our line, in between our line, and we went forwards about 2 or 5, 10 miles in front of our place. Now, we went to a village, was nobody there. Everything was closed, they saw us, you know, two people. We knock a door in a house, and my friend was speaking a little Albanian language, and we told them, our army coming now is outside of the village, about 300-400 yards. And we want some food, bread. We ask for bread, nothing else. And the proeders, which they call a Mukhtar, a guy, he called a few small kids and asked him to go around the village and get some bread. And we got 7 big, huge bread, about 10 pounds, 15 pounds each. And we carry, we put them in the sack and some in front of our coats. And we went back. That food lasted about 4 or 5 days. And we gave it to our friends, some food too, you know. They're asking, where you got it? We never told them, just eat and don't ask, you know. Anyway,
you said another story of the retreat from
From Albania. It took us 21 days walking to go down in Tripolis. When I was, my town is there outside of Tripoli, 6 miles. Without food, nobody gave us food, just eat oranges on the way, come down. Oranges and potatoes from the farms, you know, this and that, boil it. And we bought some bread, which they find it in the sea, flour in the sea. It was too salty and too smelly. Didn't smell like bread at all. But we pay, and we had a little money. We pay and we ate them. And somehow we survived. I came down to the village for 21 days walking. One day we make about, believe it or not, about 55 miles. 55, 60 miles. It was 100 kilometers, which is 60 miles, right? About 57. One day walking fast, you know, without stop. And then I came down to the village. It was a big, big disappointment when I got to Greece after Albania, because we were so many miles in Albania. When we retreat to Greece, I find the Germans in front of me. That was the most disappointment I had in my life up to now. To find, I knew, we're not going to have a good life. We are occupied. We are slaves. They're going to kill us, or they're going to do anything they want to us, you know. And coming down, a guy with 3 gold pieces, general or not general, what do you call him?
Colonel.
Colonel. He says, he talked to us if we want to go to Africa, and we decide to go. About 700 people, 700 soldiers, we took the mountains again. We left the streets. We took the mountains and we wait for orders. Yeah. We wait for orders, some kind of hypovrichion, which is a, what's hypovrichion again? Submarine. Somebody is going to come pick us up someplace, but we don't know yet where. We went about 5-6 days there up in the mountains, and still we didn't have any clear idea what going to happen to us. We're going to Africa or not? And then the colonel says he could get connected with anybody, and we make it. We lose it up and we went again out. Yeah, when I came home to my hometown, I find the Germans in my hometown, occupy my house, our house, occupy all the houses, special ours, because we have more territory. We had the store down, they occupy that one, and they leave us 2 rooms. They occupy more than the 3/4 of the house. And I couldn't even eat. I was so upset. I could go outside of the house. You can call it nervous breakdown, like I almost had it, something like that. I had no appetite to go out. My friends told my sister, "Where's Spiro? Why you don't come out?" And I didn't want to see the Germans outside, you know. And it was so bad.
I can't even imagine what it would be like going back and seeing the Germans having taken over your town and managing everyone's lives and being in fear of what comes next. It's incredible, especially as a soldier coming back from what you thought was defending your home and how quickly it fell. And I hope you're enjoying these tapes here at the Palikaya Project. There's a lot more good stuff to come. Eventually, we get to the story of Truman the Mule and the communists taking over the village after the Germans leave, and then Spiros' march to defend the country and eventually force out the communists, and then coming to the New World. All that's coming next on the next episode of the Palikaya Project. And for John Cass, Nick Cass, and the whole Cass family, and myself here at the Chicago Way, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.